This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be finishing reading excerpts from Douglas Tallamy's terrific book, The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. He started with the month of October, and I'll be finishing up reading parts of the August chapter and then the epilogue, and then a part he titles at the very end, How to Plant an Oak. He has sections here at the end, best oak options for your area. He has acknowledgments. He has an index. It's a great book to own. The August chapter has a part on cicada killers, which are a huge wasp. But don't be afraid of this wasp. It's just fascinating. It won't hurt you. It wants to kill cicadas, the annual cicadas that we hear every year. Such a beautiful sound of hot summer days. Depending on where you live, every 13 or 17 years, June brings the emergence of thousands of periodical cicadas to yards with mature trees in the eastern United States. In contrast, regardless of what year it is, one or more species of annual cicadas begin to appear by mid-July and are on the wing through much of August. They're far less numerous than periodical cicadas. Their background color of black is laced with green rather than the orange of periodical cicadas, and they're considerably larger than their periodical cousins. But like all species of cicadas, annual cicada males court females with a loud buzzing song that is a central feature of lazy hot summer days throughout the United States. Because annual cicadas are reliably present each summer, predators have been able to specialize on this dependable resource. Other than birds and squirrels that casually include cicadas in their diets, large wasps are the most unmistakable predator that eats only cicadas. These cicada killers are among the scariest, yet ironically most harmless, wasps in North America. They certainly are the biggest members of the family and can approach 2 inches in length. Unlike social hornets and yellow jackets, the cicada killer do not form hives containing a queen and hundreds of workers. Instead, they are solitary wasps that cooperate with another wasp only while mating. There are times, though, when so many are seen flying in one area, people swear there's a hive nearby. What is nearby in these cases are the two resources cicada killers need to reproduce: diggable soil and a good population of annual cicadas. A female cicada killer reproduces by capturing an annual cicada, a large insect itself, while in flight, and stinging it into a paralyzed state with a series of short flights and drags. It takes the cicada back to a vertical shaft she has previously dug in the ground. Cicada killer tunnels are substantial underground excavations that require considerable effort on the part of the female to construct. They may be nearly a foot deep before they bend horizontally for another 6 inches, and they are wide enough to allow the wasp to drag a fat cicada down to a terminal chamber. Once the cicada is in place, the wasp lays an egg on it and then leaves the tunnel for good, sealing the entrance with dirt. The egg hatches in a few days, and the cicada killer larva consumes the cicada over the following weeks. Occasionally, the female will provision her nest with more than one cicada for her young. When fully grown, the wasp larva pupates and spends the fall, winter, and spring waiting for the emergence of the first annual cicadas the following July before it ecloses to a fresh adult. Female cicada killers usually dig a new hole for each cicada they capture and will catch and bury cicadas throughout the 4 to 5 weeks of their adult lifespan. Male cicada killers, like the males of most insects, contribute nothing to child care. They are interested in one thing: mating with as many female cicada killers as possible. Lucky for them, that female cicada killers will mate after each nursery tunnel is stocked and sealed, and they will mate with the male that is strong enough to chase away all other males from the nesting site. This means males must constantly patrol areas where females are nesting, areas where the soil is just right for deep digging, so that they are on hand when a female emerges from a completed tunnel. And this is where we humans often misinterpret a male's intentions. Males, often to their detriment, are not very good at discriminating between other male cicada killers, which are legitimate rivals, and anything else that moves. They will chase your cat, your dog, your mailman, a dirt bomb tossed in their direction, or you to make sure you will not mate with the female of their dreams. If you're near an active nesting site, the males in that area take no chances. They fly straight toward you with a scowl on their harmless but admittedly scary faces. Remember, male wasps have no stinger, and they cannot hurt you in any way. But this fact is usually lost on homeowners whose yard happens to have the right type of soil for nesting wasps. Convinced they will be stung by these large wasps, too many homeowners pull out the can of Raid or pay an exterminator hundreds of dollars to kill all the wasps in their yard. Although female cicada killers do have a stinger, in my 45 years as a student of insect behavior, I've never heard of any verified case of a cicada killer stinging a human. Females are focused on one thing, finding and burying the annual cicadas produced by your oak trees. And now I'm going to read the epilogue to this book. In the preceding chapters, I have described some of the life that is associated with oaks in general and the oak trees I have planted in our yard in particular over the course of a year. None of the animals I have mentioned would be able to thrive in our yard had I not planted those oaks, and neither would any of the species that, in turn, depend on those oak-associated animals. My survey of the species that absolutely require the oaks in our yard, or just include them as one of their resources, has hardly been exhaustive. To discuss all the thousands of known animal interactions with oaks would have quickly exceeded my attention span as an author and, I'm betting, yours as a reader. Instead, my intention was, for this book, to serve as a starting point, perhaps pique your interest in oak communities, or at least increase your appreciation of the central role oaks play in ecosystems across the country, and indeed ecosystems in the Northern Hemisphere, the world over. If you are at all interested in contributing to the conservation of local animals or enjoying the wonders of nature right at home, planting one or more oaks is an awfully good way to do those things. Although oaks can live to become ancient cornerstones of ecosystems throughout the United States, the old giants that once provided so many unique niches for layers upon layers of biodiversity are now largely absent from our landscapes. Wherever oaks occurred, they were prized suppliers of wood products, and most large specimens were logged centuries ago. Long after the giants were gone, we continued to degrade oak habitats across the country. Vast tracts of oak forests have been developed. From an ecological perspective, this is one of our most ironic words. Converted to crop or pasture land, or have been highly altered by fire suppression. In fact, the percentage of oaks in eastern forests has dropped from 55% pre-European settlement to 25% today. Add pressure from the collapse of the climate that favored oak health over the last 8,000 years, as well as the human introduction of diseases like sudden oak death, oak wilt, and oak leaf scorch, and invasive pests like the gypsy moth, and many oak species are now on the ropes. A recent analysis by the Morton Arboretum in Illinois has found that 28 of the 91 oak species in North America are so diminished in numbers they may soon disappear from the wild forever. The noble Oregon white oak, for example, has lost 97% of its habitat in the last 200 years. We cannot casually accept the loss of oaks without also accepting the loss of thousands of other plants and animals that depend on them. Oak declines in the United Kingdom, for example, threaten the survival of some 2,300 other species. Fortunately, there's no reason why we should accept the loss of oaks as inevitable. There is no trick to restoring oak populations, and no shortage of places in which to restore them. If you were to add up the amount of land in various types of built landscapes that is not dedicated to agriculture, suburban developments, urban parks, golf courses, mine reclamation sites, and so forth, it would total 603 million acres, a full 33% of our lower 48 states. We have not targeted these places for conservation in the past, but that was back when our conservation model was based on the notion that humans and their tailings were here and nature was someplace else. That model of mutual exclusion has failed us dismally. There simply are not enough untrammeled places left to sustain the natural world that until now has sustained us. Our only option then is to find ways to coexist with other species. That's right, we must construct ecosystems that contain all their functional parts right where humans abound. And I'm going to interrupt here and remind you of the website and organization called Homegrown National Park. We all can become part of the Homegrown National Park. Look it up on the internet. Back to Douglas Tallamy. This may turn out to be easier than you think. From the perspective of effective conservation, it is fortuitous that many of our human-dominated landscapes, think suburbia, structurally resemble the highly diverse, sun-drenched ecosystems that once dominated North America. That squirrel we have heard about that could run through treetops from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi River without ever touching the ground may never have existed. There is growing evidence that deciduous forests throughout the United States, in fact, temperate zones the world over, were historically much more open than the dark, closed canopy forests of today, resembling savannas dotted with a diversity of large spreading trees, as well as a rich assemblage of sun-loving prairie plants and all the insects, birds, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians that depend on them. What kept these forests open, it is thought, were the enormous and abundant Pleistocene mammals that dominated North America for millions of years. Mammals like the American mastodon that stood 10 feet high at the shoulder, giant ground sloths that could reach vegetation 15 feet high, and more. Herds of giant bison, 4,000-pound beasts that dwarfed extant bison, camels, horses, tapirs, peccaries, the list goes on. The elimination of these browsers at the end of the Pleistocene allowed forests in the northern hemisphere to become more dense and shaded than they ever were in the past, suppressing prairie plant species that require lots of light. Where once there were hundreds of plant species per acre, there are now relatively few. My point is, we may be able to restore much of the biodiversity of old without restructuring the physical aspects of where we live, work, and play now simply by adding the right plants to our existing landscapes. We humans live our lives out in a brief instant of ecological time. We cannot return ancient oaks to our landscapes during that instant, but we can, indeed we must, start the process. I have planted a number of massive old oaks on our property, except that they are only 19 years old and are not so massive yet. They are growing, though, and several have topped 30 feet at this writing. In a blink of time, they'll be large enough and old enough to fully assume their keystone positions in our yard. And just in time, our winner-take-all extraction-based economies, coupled with our unchecked population expansion, have triggered the sixth great extinction event of planet Earth's 4-billion-year history. Over 1 million species are headed for extinction in the next few years unless we take immediate action. We have no choice but to prevent such losses, not because we're nice guys, but because it is those species that run the ecosystems that support us. And by we, I mean every single human Earth dweller, not just the surprisingly few people who already recognize the necessity of sustainable Earth stewardship. Although their impending demise is bad enough, it is not the loss of rare and endangered species that we should fear. Their populations are no longer large enough to have major impacts on our ecosystems. Rather, it is the loss of the common kingpins like oaks that we must prevent, as if our well-being depends on them, for it does. And that's the end of the epilogue. And now his ending chapter, How to Plant an Oak. Whether you add oaks to your landscape by planting acorns, small bare roots, or larger bald and burlap trees, knowing a few basics about planting oaks can make the difference between failure and success, regardless of which route you take. Step one is choosing an appropriate site for your oak. The most important thing to remember is that oaks grow, and contrary to urban legend, many species grow quite quickly. With this in mind, be sure to allocate enough space for your oak so that it can seamlessly join other plants in your landscape when it's a mature tree. It takes a little imagination to picture your landscape 10, 20, 30 years down the road, but it's worth this planning exercise. Those years fly by faster than any of us think they will. Planting time is also when you should consider adding a grove of oaks rather than isolated singletons. As I described in the February chapter, two or three trees planted within 10 feet of each other will interlock their roots as they grow and therefore be far less vulnerable to dangerous blowdowns when they mature. These are not unnaturally tight spacings in our forests, just in our minds. Although I may not succeed, I'm going to try to convince you to plant acorns rather than transplant established trees. Acorns are easy, free, and plentiful, and they will grow into healthier trees than if you transplant established trees. The only thing they don't give you is instant gratification. But if you decide to try acorns, here are a few hints to help you out. First, know which species you are planting. Members of the white oak group germinate in the fall, just days after dropping from the parent tree. These should be planted soon after collecting, about a half inch deep. Pretend you're a squirrel or a blue jay storing your nut for the winter. Your acorns will send down their taproot during the fall, but will not appear above ground until spring. In contrast, members of the red oak group do not germinate until the following spring. Even so, don't wait until spring to collect your red oak acorns. Usually the only ones you will find in the spring will be inferior or damaged acorns already rejected by myriad acorn eaters over the wintertime. As with acorns from the white oak group, collect your red oak acorns soon after they drop in the fall and either plant them right away or store them in a sealed plastic bag filled with damp peat moss in the refrigerator until mid-March. This will protect them from hungry rodents during the long winter months. This brings us to an important decision when planting acorns. If you plant them directly into the ground at their final resting site, chances are good they will be found and destroyed by some critter before they germinate. For this reason, I plant my acorns in deep flower pots in a mixture of your local soil and potting mix that drains well. You will then need to protect your pot from marauding mice, preferably someplace that is exposed to some of winter's cold, but not the full might of a polar vortex. Remember, your pot won't receive any moderating warmth from the unfrozen soil beneath it, as it would if your acorn were planted directly in the ground. Another winter challenge is desiccation. If you store your pot where it will not be exposed to seasonal rain or snow, your acorn may dry out. You can avoid this problem by lightly watering about once a month. In the spring, wait until your seedling has fully expanded its first true leaves before transplanting it into the ground, but don't wait too long. Oaks grown in pots quickly become root-bound, a condition that often kills the tree months or years after transplanting. This all may sound pretty complicated, but it's really not that hard, and in my view, beats spending the thousands of dollars that would otherwise go toward buying a large tree. Speaking of large trees, this is the most common way people acquire oaks, but it comes with serious downsides. For the sake of instant gratification and because of the mistaken notion that if you plant a small tree, you'll be dead before you get to enjoy it, many people are willing to spend many thousands of dollars to buy a 3 to 4 inch caliper oak. Again, there are so many disadvantages to this approach that installing large oaks is at the very bottom of my how to get an oak list, but it is an option. There's a reasonable compromise between planting an acorn and buying a large tree, and that is to buy an inexpensive bare root whip. Bare root whips are heavily pruned, dormant trees just a few feet tall. All the dirt has been removed from their roots, hence bare root. So they're light and easily transported and only cost a few dollars each. You can store your bare root for a few days before planting as long as you keep the roots moist within a plastic bag. It's best to plant bare roots in early spring so they can break dormancy in sync with the season. Dig a hole 1/3 wider than the roots, as they would spread naturally from the trunk, but be careful not to dig the hole deeper than the crown, the area on the trunk where the first roots appear. Planting a tree below its crown is the most common way to kill it. Some people like to dig a deep hole and then backfill it to the proper depth, but this should be avoided as well. Backfilled soil will settle over time, resulting in a tree whose crown is below grade. Once you're sure the tree is not too deep, fill your hole while holding the tree upright in place. Jiggle the roots up and down a bit to make sure the soil fills in all the spaces among the roots, and water your planting liberally the first day or two. Depending on where you live, your young oak will probably need protection from mammals like rabbits and deer. I use a 5-foot circular wire cage of galvanized steel that is wide enough so that the young tree can spread its branches without being bent out of shape by the cage. If you're starting from an acorn, you'll want to increase the cage size as the small tree grows. I admit these cages are unsightly, but until we get our deer populations under control, I've found them to be the most fuel-proof way of preventing deer damage. Few things are more infuriating than to nurse along an oak for several years only to have a deer snip off its leader because you took the cage off too soon. Your oak will outgrow dangers from deer soon enough, at which point you can celebrate graduation day, the day you remove the cage for good. And that's the end of my reading of Douglas Tallamy's book, The Nature of Oaks. The rich ecology are our most essential native trees. I also want to mention another book that's really terrific. It's a book dedicated to our region. It's called Gardening for Moths, A Regional Guide by Jim McCormack, McCormack, and Chelsea Gottfried, Gottfried. And this is your understory below your oaks. It'll give you all kinds of confidence and purpose in planting a whole variety of gardening for moths. And really, gardening for moths means gardening for caterpillars. And that's what Tallamy's been talking about, is the importance, chapter after chapter after chapter, of caterpillars and all the good they do and all the interesting life histories that they have. So look up this wonderful, I have it in paperback here in front of me, Gardening for Moths, A Regional Guide, right in our backyard this book is devoted to, by McCormack and Gottfried. So I hope you're inspired to do some native plantings in your backyard and join the Backyard National Parks movement. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thanks so much for listening.